This is an ABC podcast.
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
A cancer diagnosis is overwhelming and frightening, and initially you have more questions than your brain can keep up with. But information, support groups and research, they all help when you're trying to piece together the information that you've received and how it may impact your life. But what if your cancer is rare? We know a lot about breast cancer, prostate cancer. We're even learning more about ovarian cancer. But what about the cancers we don't know a lot about? And what actually defines a rare cancer? Approximately 52,000 Australians are diagnosed with a rare or a less common cancer every year. That's one person every 10 minutes. And around 25,000 people will lose their lives, so that's 69 people every day. So why do some cancers receive more attention? And not that we, by any stretch of the imagination, want this to be a competition. But how does that awareness, how does that impact research, clinical trials, support groups, general funding? How does it impact diagnosis, specialists and treatment? And fundamentally, how does having a rare cancer impact your health outcome and ultimately your survival? So if you or someone close to you has had a diagnosis of a rare cancer, was it hard to find information, support groups and specialists?
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
Good morning, my name's Rochelle Hunt, and today we throw a spotlight onto rare cancer. But the big question is, what defines a rare cancer? Joining you in the studio for this hour, Danielle Spence, who's the Head of Strategy and Support Division at the Cancer Council of Victoria, and Professor Claire Scott, who's the Joint Division Head of the Clinical Discovery Translation and the Head of the Ovarian and Rare Cancers Laboratory at the Walter and Eliza Hall Institute of Medical Research. Danielle and Claire, a warm welcome to the Conversation Hour. When we talk about rare cancer, what defines a rare cancer? Because ultimately, every cancer diagnosis, Claire, is individual. So what makes a cancer rare?
So there is a definition that's accepted worldwide, and it comes down to incidence, which is how many people are diagnosed per year, and it's less than 6 per 100,000 people per year. So what falls into that? You've already mentioned some of the big common cancers, so breast, bowel, prostate, melanoma, for example. In fact, for any type of cancer organ in the body that you can think of, when we look down the microscope, we have different types of cancers. So it could be adenocarcinoma or squamous cell carcinoma. Usually there's one major type, one major histologic type, and that is common or less common. But when you get to those lesser histologic subtypes, nearly all of them are rare. So we have a very long list. We have hundreds, between 200 and 300 types of cancers are rare.
So there's rare, and then there's rare.
Yeah, and we do. We call it super rare, ultra rare. Okay. So that would be an incidence of less than 0.01 per 100,000. And we have to care for these, you know, people all the time.
And how hard is it to get a diagnosis? Does it make it even trickier to get the right diagnosis given the rarity? If we're talking ultra rare, does it get harder and harder to diagnose?
It does. And, you know, we know that it's very challenging for people facing a rare cancer diagnosis to get their diagnosis confirmed and their management plan approved. And one of the issues there is that you just have so many people who are in this situation. It's about a quarter of all patients who have cancer, but it affects different types of cancer. So it depends whether your cancer is related, for example, to the bowel or to the gynecological tract or to the urogenital tract or to the chest. So there's just a lot of detective work, in fact, that needs to go on at the beginning.
Absolutely. Sam's called us from the CBD. Good morning, Sam.
Hi, how are you going?
Really well. What did you want to share?
Well, I had a very rare salivary gland tumour when I was in my 20s.
And how was that? How did that diagnosis come about, Sam?
or it presented itself as a swollen gland from a sore throat. And then the swollen gland didn't go away, and then that ended up being the subject of a surgical biopsy and then a subsequent surgical excision of my salivary gland.
How tricky was it for you to get information and, you know, to find support peer-to-peer, even just written information on your type of cancer, Sam?
Well, this was a very long time ago, pre-internet, so it was...
Harder again.
40-odd years ago. What my surgeon told me was that in 40 years at the Royal Melbourne Hospital, they had seen 10 people with my cancer, five of whom had had radiotherapy and five of whom had not. So there was absolutely no statistically meaningful evidence about whether radiotherapy follow-up was good, bad, or indifferent. Wow. So it was this kind of very rare, what do we do, situation. And being young as I was at the time, I wasn't keen to have my jaw irradiated. And there was a bit of a lotto, and there was a fair bit of uncertainty, especially in the first few years post-surgically. But it all turned out okay in the end, I should say. But having a very rare cancer and at that time very limited ability to research was very difficult.
Sam, stay with us, because Claire, that would be common, I would think, across rare cancers, where, like Sam, maybe like your specialist, sort of feels like a bit of a lotto or a gamble when it comes to how do we help you, how do we treat you?
Look, Sam, I think that was a fantastic description, very meaningful to me, of how what you had to go through when you were diagnosed. And I can assure you that there are many other Australians out there facing a similar thing at the moment, and perhaps with more information due to the internet. But who really wants to be dependent on the internet for their information? So I agree, and being treated in a major, you know, tertiary centre is a really good thing if that can happen. It's not always possible, and we'll talk more about that later. But still, you're right. There are types of cancers where we only have, you know, one or two per year, which means if we look back over the last 5 years, we can come up with what happened to the last 10 patients. But that's still a really small experience to draw conclusions about which type of treatment, let alone offering patients meaningful information about what they're facing and indeed what their future holds.
Sam, what advice would you have for people listening that maybe have also had a diagnosis of a rare cancer and feel maybe a little bit lost?
Well, what I did was I asked lots of medical practitioners. I guess I was in a privileged position of having access to being able to speak to a lot of people. The truth is, I'd really like to give a huge shout out to the late and great Brian Fleming, who was the head surgeon at the head and neck department at the Royal Melbourne, who was just the most wonderful, gentle, considerate guide in terms of what I should or shouldn't do that one could ever wish for in a medical practitioner.
It's really great to hear, Sam, and that you had your support. Thanks so much for calling us. Everything that Sam has just spoken about, I guess, could be translated to not all cancer diagnosis, but those rare cancers where you think, well, where can I arm myself with information? Danielle, how helpful, I mean, the Cancer Council's website is incredible, right? It is this great tool and resource for so many people. But as Sam said, his diagnosis was pre the internet. Is the internet helpful and is it harmful sometimes? I know when my mum got a diagnosis, but the diagnosis was still a bit sketchy. If the first thing I did was chuck it into Google, I ended up an absolute mess in the corner. I went down rabbit holes I should never have gone down. It was horrific. And my husband had to come in and say, I'm shutting this computer down. You can't look at it anymore. How do we find that balance?
Hi, Rochelle, and terrific to be having this conversation about such an important topic. What we want to do as organisations who are providing information to people with cancer is really empower people. We want to empower them with information so they can start having conversations with their specialists early and ask the right questions. And, of course, the internet is an abyss, and how do you avoid going down those rabbit holes? And I think the best advice we can give is go to reputable websites. Go to information on Cancer Council's website, cancer.org.au. it's evidence-based, it's been put together, it's been reviewed by people who've had cancers, by specialists, and it's up to date all the time. And I think that's where you can start to get that self-empowerment, so you can go back armed with the right information, ask the right questions, and also let your family and your friends have a look at that information as well.
Before we have a chat to Rhonda, who's called us from Oakley, Claire, how tricky is it to get a specialist, to get a good team, to get a surgeon, to get all of those things that you need to wrap around you when your cancer is rare?
I think you were saying earlier that there might be a little bit of luck involved, and I think that is important. Sometimes you can land right in the right place and there is someone who is relevant for your type of rare cancer. But otherwise, it is helpful to keep asking. So to speak to the doctors you've got, ask them if they could recommend anyone else if they don't know exactly who you should speak to. Rare Cancers Australia is a charity with a website, and they have these conversations with people every single day. So they're very good at trying to help find the right centre for someone close to where they are, and whenever possible close to the doctors they're with. We also have the Australian Rare Cancer Portal, which I lead, and that has been set up, originally funded by the government, in order to ensure that patients have a better chance of staying with their doctors and not having to move. And this is particularly important for regional and more remote people. So in this case, you will be referred by your specialist to the ARC portal. You will consent, because nearly all rare cancer based knowledge is in the research space, so it makes a lot of sense to consent as a research participant for that, so that the knowledge can come back and help others. And then your case will be in detail provided to doctors from the portal, who will then look at all of the international guidelines, all of the literature. If there aren't guidelines, as there often aren't for rare cancers, then they'll look at best practice based on what has been published. And then they'll write a 6 to 7 page report that's reviewed by a number of senior doctors within the ARC portal, and then is sent to your treating doctor. So that would be your cancer specialist. Because not all cancer specialists are specialists in all types of rare cancers.
That's right. Impossible. And when we talk about the role of the internet and the good and the bad, something like this portal, and I want to get into that a little more, because I know last time, Danielle, when we spoke about clinical trials, there might only be 4 or 5 people in a clinical trial, and they might be dotted in all different parts of the world. So you might have one person in Australia, another person in Denmark, and another person in Bangladesh. You're listening to Danielle Spence, the Head of Strategy and Support Division at the Cancer Council of Victoria, and Professor Claire Scott, who's the Joint Division Head of the Clinical Discovery Translation and Head of the Ovarian and Rare Cancers Laboratory at the Walter and Eliza Hall Institute of Medical Research. Rhonda, you've been waiting so patiently in Oakley. Good morning.
Thanks for the opportunity. I had what's called soft tissue sarcoma, and it took them several months to find out it was, because I had a pain. I said to my doctor, I want an x-ray, and it went from there and was picked up, and then MRIs, blood tests, all sorts of things. And 4 months later, on August last year, I had it removed, and 2 ribs removed and part of my lung.
How much did you feel like you had to advocate for yourself throughout that process, Rhonda?
Well, I'd had to previous breast cancers over a 43-year period, but this really it rocked me a bit, because it was, I didn't know anything about it, and they seemed to be not sure themselves initially. But I had wonderful care at the Royal Melbourne. I can't speak more highly of them, and I didn't have to have any further treatment as I did before, so I was very grateful for that.
Yeah, Rhonda, it's good to hear. Thank you. Thank you for your call. When we're talking about access in regional areas, there's a text here from Anonymous that it just says there's a 4-year-plus wait to see a specialist in Bendigo in the public system. How hard is it to even get to see a specialist at the moment?
We actually work really closely with the Bendigo cancer specialists in the ARC portal. And so I do know that with a new cancer diagnosis, it is possible to get into the cancer specialists at the Bendigo Base Hospital within a reasonable time frame. That is usually less than a month, or, you know, it shouldn't really be more than 2 months. So I think sometimes it's more difficult to get a new appointment if someone doesn't know what it's for. So when someone thinks that they have a real problem and sees their doctor and their doctor, you know, says agrees and thinks that they have a cancer diagnosis, I think it's just really important to keep reaching out to cancer specialists wherever you can, because with telehealth these days, we can also start that process of discussion over telehealth. And so that means if your local centre is too busy, we should be able to get you in to see a cancer specialist somewhere else. I think COVID really helped that, and we've the government's been great in supporting our continued use of telehealth for that sort of reason.
There's a shout out here from Rod to the Traralgon Hospital, who said, my wife was diagnosed with stage 4 bile duct cancer from day one. After 3 years of chemo, she passed away in my arms. And a shout out to Traralgon Hospital. Rod, we're so sorry to hear that about your wife, but it is also good to know that incredible work is being done in Gippsland in Traralgon. Niall's called from Warren Ponds. Neil, yeah. Apologies. Yeah, hi, Neil. Neil. Sorry,
hi,
Neil.
How are you going?
I'm good, mate. That's what did you want to share?
So, 2011, my late wife was diagnosed with endocarcinoma. And after surgery, the recommendation was no chemo, didn't react well to that and all that sort of stuff. So we went down the path of just sort of waiting and seeing after surgery, and it got to 6 months, all good. Didn't get to 12 months. So then started an aggressive chemotherapy and radiotherapy process. And unfortunately, after nearly 5 years, we lost her in 2015.
Oh, Neil, I'm sorry to hear that. What would have helped you and your wife, Neil?
Oh, like the scary thing was when you go into the hospital and the nurses are actually Googling what she's got.
Yeah, wow. I've just had a whole body reaction to that, yeah.
Yeah. Well, we were doing the same. Like we basically were pretty much given a death sentence from day one. But she, to her credit, she fought hard, got the kids pretty much all through school, apart from my daughter. So 2016 was my daughter Zoe's year 12 year. And to her credit, she busted her balls and got through, you know. And she's now, after a period of time, nearly finished her teaching in Ballarat.
Congrats. Yeah. And how are you, Neil? How's it all impacted you?
It was a tough time for me. I was an employee of Old Car, and I'd just been made redundant just before she passed away.
Mm.
And, so it was a double whammy. And, and to make it worse, or in some ways, we remember her more, it was actually Christmas Day she passed away.
Mm.
And so we do a Christmas, I've never been the same, but some Christmas morning or her birthday, whichever we can all get together on, mainly Christmas morning, we do sunrise on the beach somewhere.
Beautiful.
Together as a family. So this year, for me, I've just gone into semi-retirement, and I'm doing a Peter Mac Foundation fundraiser hike.
Things like that help, don't they, Neil?
Yeah, they do. I don't know, it's too late for to help Andrea.
Yeah.
But it's going to help someone else. And, it's good for me. For me, it's got me back in my old footy jumper from 35 years ago.
Great.
So I'm averaging over 10 k's a day walking. And, the hike I'm doing, and I'm so looking forward to it, is the Larapinta Trail in Central Australia.
Good on you.
And, it's good for me in a lot of ways. And, it's tough now. It's probably tougher now that the kids have all left home and doing, and for their credit, they're all getting on with their lives and doing their thing. But I'm still in the big house on my own, so...
Yeah. Yeah, it all changes. That's the thing with grief. It comes and goes, and it never really leaves, you know, and it comes back. And I just think it's so great, Neil, that you're doing that hike. Claire?
And Neil, I just want to really thank you, because what you're essentially doing is fundraising for research, and that is the only way that we're going to make a difference. And you're such a strong advocate in everything you say. We have, you know, many others like you who are doing the same, and hats off to every single person. But research, both clinical trials and also research in the lab, is the only way we can really unpick the true way to the best treatment for these many, many different types of rare cancers. These days we have, you know, a lot of molecular complexity, so we have to look at genes in the cancer and try and match those to treatments. And we just can't do that fast enough for all the rare cancer types without more research. So thank you.
Neil, thank you. And we wish you all the best. Enjoy your hike.
Yeah, and all I can say is for the listeners out there, look me up on Peter Mac fundraiser page and put something into it for me.
Fantastic.
Good
fantastic
on you, Neil.
Suggestion.
Absolutely. That's an important part of this, though. I like Neil, I would do the tan on Mother's Day. It was for breast cancer. My mother didn't have breast cancer, but I found it helped, right? It gave me, I felt like I was with my tribe. It helped me grieve. It just gave me a sense of moment and purpose and place.
We have the Mother's Day Classic coming up in May,
actually.
Exactly. So my lab has a group that are running, and we're running with patients, with family, friends, with members within our own group who've undergone cancer or had a close family member die of cancer. So I agree, it's an incredibly humbling and emotional day, but really worthwhile.
How do rare cancers get those big days? How do they get the hikes, the Mother's Day classics?
So actually this year, the Mother's Day classic included ovarian cancer, and all subtypes of ovarian cancer are rare. So that means that that type of rare cancer is being acknowledged. Rare Cancers Australia, the charity I mentioned before, they do a hike to the top of Mount Kosciuszko from Canberra. They call it from the lowest in the land to the highest in the land, and they do that every year. And they've been pivotal in bringing a whole lot of people together for that. So it's not only patients and families, researchers, doctors, but also industry and other corporates who have been incredibly important in supporting research for rare cancers.
Because it sounds awful to say, but often you need an ambassador, a famous person, a name. You could take Neil Danaher and MND, for example, and the incredible work that one individual and his notoriety has done for that particular disease. You can look at Jay McGrath. And I remember doing a previous conversation on rare blood cancers, and I had a woman ring this station. She said, "This sounds awful," and she said, "I hate myself for saying this, but sometimes I just think if someone famous got this, then they would understand, or there would be a spotlight put onto what I'm going through." Is that something that the Cancer Council looks at in terms of how do we put a spotlight on all cancers?
Absolutely. And for us, it's really around how do we ensure that our research funding can support rare cancers and exploring new treatments for rare cancers. And over the last 4 years, Cancer Council's contributed $3.2 million to research funding for rare cancers and less common cancers. But I think it is challenging to raise community awareness around cancers that, as Claire said, might be 0.1% of all of the people that are diagnosed with cancer in this country every year. So it's really about raising the profile, and we can do that through stories. And people that are calling in today, the stories are so important, because even though someone may not have exactly the same cancer, some of the common threads that people will have when they get a rare cancer, it doesn't have to be the same, but it's still the loneliness, it's still the isolation, it's still the fear, it's still dealing with the uncertainty. And some of the treatments can be common amongst other people who have a different type of cancer. So it's around how do we corral all of that and ensure that people aren't feeling that they're going through this cancer in isolation and by themselves.
But do you need the person, the cause, the ambassador for the money for the research? Because there's not funding for all research. And if there was some kind of magic lever that could be pulled so there could be more funding, more clinical trials, how do you manage that?
So we do it by trying to organise ourselves nationally and to borrow infrastructure that exists for common cancers whenever we can appropriate it for rare. So an example would be the MOST program, which was funded by the government, which allowed us to do a lot of genomic testing of cancers. So about two-thirds of those cancers were rare. So it wasn't set up purely for rare, but it has really changed the future for patients with rare in terms of trying to get more information about their cancer. But then that bit sort of begs the next question. What do you do once you've found a gene change that tells you what drug treatment you should have? The problem is it's really hard to get drug approvals through the PBAC for rare contexts because there just simply isn't enough data, not the sort of level of data that they require for these more common cancer types. But to give you some examples, so we focus on rare gynecological cancers, and we have had a couple of really good drug approvals in the last 12 months, including for cervical cancer, which is a very rare cancer. And that means that women, if they have advanced disease, even at first presentation, can get immunotherapy as well as chemotherapy. Now, that's been accepted for, for example, for lung cancer for quite a long time. So we're so thrilled that we're starting to catch
because
up.
Because that's part of it too. The drugs may be there and the research may be there. It's just the approval.
And one of the things that is really important as well is our screening programs, because we're hoping to be the first jurisdiction to eliminate cervical cancer by 2030. And that's an incredible, if we achieve that in Australia, in Victoria, that's an incredible feat to think we might have actually have eliminated a cancer that takes the lives of people with the cervix. So it is about screening. It's right from the beginning of how do we turn our attention to doing something about these type of rare cancers.
Danielle Spencer's with you, Head of Strategy and Support Division at the Cancer Council, and Professor Claire Scott as well, Joint Division and Head of the Clinical Discovery Translation and Head of the Ovarian and Rare Cancers Laboratory at the Walter and Eliza Hull Institute of Medical Research.
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
Good morning, Rochelle Hunt here with you, Danielle Spencer, Professor Claire Scott with you as well, as we look at rare cancers. A lot of really incredible texts on this, and I'm going to try and get through as many of them as I possibly can throughout the course of the day. But I do like to try and read them before I read them out loud to make sure that it is something that you want me to read out loud. So please, I am getting through them slowly and I will try and read them out as many as I can. This one, great topic today. My friend is in the throes of a possible diagnosis of a rare cancer. Her journey so far has been a roller coaster, and she may end up dodging the bullet and not having cancer, but she lives in a regional area and doesn't have health insurance. Up until now, she's been looked after by the local oncology team, who are amazing, but I just wonder sometimes how possible it would be for her to go to a larger hospital in Melbourne. The idea of being able to pick your team and move around, especially if you're in regional areas, I guess that's where the portal comes in as well, to be able to try and help people. But let's speak to Marilyn, who's been waiting so patiently. Good morning, Marilyn.
Good morning. I just wanted to share with you some of my mother's story. She had cancer of the mouth and the throat back in the 1930s, early 30s. And she lived to 85.
Wow.
And I would not be here if a person called a Dr. Kay Scott had not treated her back at that time with what then was a new thing called radiation therapy. And I just am so grateful that 11 years later, she was actually able to conceive me and I'm here. And it's something that I just feel that people need to always hold on to some hope that there is something that comes along that can help you.
Yeah, there's something around the corner. You would have both witnessed, Marilyn, thank you, treatments, advancements in treatments. And is it like Marilyn said, is it that hope of what is around the corner? I mean, without that, what do we have?
Look, we talk about that every day in the clinic. You're absolutely right. We do have clinical trials with new drugs coming through, drugs that we think have a reason to expect that they'll perform better and cause less toxicity. It's excruciating having to wait for the trials to be completed and then the data to come out and then even further to wait for drug approvals to come through. But it is a constantly moving space. I also just want to really shout out about the courage that we just heard displayed. Someone who was having what was then a very new treatment, which of course has become a mainstay, radiation therapy. But rare cancer patients are often having to accept treatment plans with very little evidence. In medicine, we always try to practice evidence-based medicine, and ultimately it's each individual patient with a rare cancer who might be advised to try a certain program where there is very little evidence, and that's a very scary place to be. But we do look at a whole lot of other reasons for interpreting why we think that program would be good for them, so we do provide as much kind of adjacent evidence as we can. Still, that's not good enough to really make a difference. We want to be studying the rare cancer, you know, in detail and understanding what the best treatment would be.
Danielle, last time we spoke, we looked at clinical trials, and people want to go back and listen to that, they can go to the Conversation Hour. You can subscribe to the Conversation Hour, go to the ABC Listen app, or just chuck Conversation Hour clinical trials into Google and you'll be able to listen to that. But one thing that came out of it was how little and how few there are, and then on top of it, the availability of being able to put your hand up and participate in something in a clinical trial for a rare cancer. It almost feels more important to have clinical trials and access to research for a rare cancer.
Absolutely. And, you know, the statistic is really low. Only less than 6% of people with cancer will have access to a clinical trial. And if you have a rare cancer, especially if you're being treated outside of a major metropolitan or a major tertiary centre, it's really important to be asking that question. Ask for a second opinion. Ask if there is a centre where there is clinical trial, where there's research happening. Ask if you can speak to someone who specialises in more rare cancers, like Claire, because this is the entry point for people to be able to have, even if they can't get onto a clinical trial, at least they are able to have an informed conversation to think about what's the best option for them.
Well, I can tell you hand on heart, I spoke with somebody who listened to that program who has a cancer diagnosis and is going through treatment at the moment, who didn't know anything about clinical trials. And they said to me, next time I speak to my specialist, I'm going to ask them what clinical trials I have available, and they said to say thank you.
Oh, that's great.
Courtney's in Mount Albert. Hi, Courtney.
Oh, g'day. I just want to make two quick points if I can. I've got a very rare form of kidney cancer, and I find the whole, I was just listening to your conversation there about trials, and I find the whole setting in cancer set up for to support people with... Sorry, I'll just take it off speakerphone here for a bit of delay.
The whole setup is to support people with non-rare cancers. Yeah. And I'll give you my example is that I'm currently on a drug which is non-PBS subsidised. And as a result, I'm out of pocket $3,000 every 3 weeks.
Oh, gosh.
I'm very fortunate that I'm on two drugs. One drug is actually $10,000 a month.
Oh,
But the drug company is completely subsidising that for me. But with this other drug that I'm taking, which is immunotherapy, the drug company's in negotiation with the government trying to get wider access to their drug. But even if that does become available, it's not going to cover my rare cancer because there's an inherent disincentive for drug companies to even apply for rare cancers to be on the PBS. So I think there needs to be a lot more flexibility in the system.
Gosh, what did you say? $3,000 how often, Courtney?
Every 3 weeks.
Courtney, stay with us because we... Danielle, I mean, it's
an absolute
crazy
barrier, and really acknowledging the challenge around that and the frustration for people to be told that there is a drug that could help them, but it is unaffordable. And for many people, that would be totally out of reach. It's one of the biggest areas of advocacy for organisations like Cancer Council, Rare Cancer, another organisation that Claire mentioned. We did have a Senate inquiry last year. We did put in submissions saying about the, you know, it feels like injustice of not being able to get access to treatment.
Absolutely it does. Do you feel like it's injustice, Courtney?
Oh, I do, and I'm in a fortunate position to be able to, you know, pay for that drug, but I know, you know, a lot of people wouldn't be able to. I mean, it obviously has a big financial burden on my family, but at least I can get access to it. And I just think there needs to be more flexibility in the system for rare cancers. You know, the other point I'd make is you're talking about trials.
Mm.
There is a disincentive, at least in my case, with a rare form of kidney cancer, for drug companies to even give me access to trials because the likelihood of a positive outcome for me impacts their numbers negatively on the trial. So most kidney cancer trials exclude my rare type of cancer. So again, there needs to be a way for rare cancers to be involved more in generic trials and not be a penalty to the pharma company if it brings down their overall results.
I know something, Courtney, when we were talking about this last time, and Claire, you may be able to answer this, is would change happen if we actually produced more of and if we made more of the medicines here, if we made more, if it was available, if it was made locally?
I don't know how feasible that is for Australia, as we have a very small population. India is a good example. So they will often make some of the major drugs, that the new anti-cancer drugs that we frequently prescribe. So it does work in India, but I suspect Australia is too small to have the quality control to be able to do that.
Do you have any control over things like if Courtney wants to pay for and take that drug, even if for the drug company it doesn't look good, in inverted commas, on their record? Bad luck.
So, look, this is something that we are discussing all the time, both within clinical trials as we develop them, and I could point you to the gynecological website, for example, ANSCOG, the Australian New Zealand Gynecological Oncology Group, and each main type of cancer has a clinical trial group, a national clinical trial group. And on those websites, usually patients can contact and get help and advice. So who to include in a trial is as long as a piece of string. It's a really big question. But the other thing about accessing drugs where we have established that there's a really important need for that drug for a particular patient with a rare cancer, that can be done through the ARC portal or through Rare Cancers Australia as well, because they have a patient treatment fund where you can contact them via their website, explain your scenario, and they will help you set up a GoFundMe page. It does use your social network, but actually the people who donate are often just people you don't know, people who are interested and realise the injustice of the current medical system. So I think it's really tough. It's tough for the PBAC because they try to be data-focused, which is fair enough. What we really need is to look at other examples of doing things. So, for example, if you have a cancer type adjacent to a cancer that's just had a an approval, can that be broadened? And in fact, that you know, that is done occasionally, and so a subgroup is included where it wasn't actually part of the trial.
Good on you, Courtney. As we said, we wish you absolutely all the best. Having those advocates, having those people around you, having support teams as well. And I also want to go back and acknowledge Neil and the advocates and support for the partners and for the family, because a lot of love, Neil, if you're still listening, mate, there is a lot of love. Hopefully that that your fundraising page will go up, because here's this one that's from Margaret, and it says, my heart goes out to Neil. I'm now widowed. Kids also left home. I moved out of my cold house into a lovely flat in a great neighbourhood in Richmond. I recommend that sort of change. It's lifelong and the impacts run through generations. So when we talk about research and clinical trials and how it helps, and I know, Danielle, this is something for you, who you've had a cancer diagnosis, when you think about research and clinical trials, it's not just for it helping you, it's for helping someone else, it's for helping the next generation.
Absolutely, and we talked about that last time. I was diagnosed in 2014 with melanoma, and then I had a recurrence, a metastatic recurrence in 2021. And then in 2021, I was able to access the drugs that people back in 2014 were participating in clinical trials to discover the benefit of those drugs. So I am someone who has been able to benefit from others that went before me, and I think that altruistic sense of I may not be able to help myself, but I want to help others is very strong in people. But of course, we want to save lives, and we want everyone to be able to access new treatments. And it can be incredibly difficult for people who want to get on a clinical trial. They may not access that trial, but even if they can't, you know, have a conversation with your oncologist, get your oncologist to lobby the pharmaceutical company, because there are access schemes, and people can get subsidised for some of these expenses.
How hard do you have to push?
You do have to push hard. And, you know, some of the big advocacy organisations, for example, Breast Cancer Network Australia and other big organisations have really led the way in this space by really lobbying the pharmaceutical companies, putting in submissions when they go to PBAC, talking to government, you know, putting in submissions to Senate inquiries into these rare and less common cancers, because it is that community voice that can drive change as well.
Should it be up to patients, family and friends and, you know, the bolshy parent that you might have to lobby to make change? Or should it be a couple of steps before that, Claire, do you think? I mean, fundamentally, should some of these pharma companies actually have to tick boxes that say, we will allow access to rare cancers to X, Y and Z? Yes, okay, it's great to lobby, but my God, should we have to?
There haven't been a set of rules as such, but one thing Rare Cancers Australia has done is bring in, you know, probably more than 10 major pharmaceutical companies to really help them understand the issues. We also can influence things by having rapid pathways for drug approval set up by the PBAC. So there are things that the government can do to prioritise. We also have orphan drug designations. So if there's the total amount of money is less than a certain number of million for that patient subgroup, then that approval might go through more quickly. So these are the more generic types of processes that can, you know, be improved upon. It is important for, I think whenever you have change in society, it is because of advocates, really.
Yeah.
And the problem is it's such a rapidly moving space. If you think that a quarter of people with cancer in Australia have a rare cancer of 250, 300 types, it sounds like an impossible task. So all you're going to have to do is to continue to advocate at every level.
And the other thing is too, you don't want survival rates to be a matter of privilege.
Absolutely, and that is a problem in our system. Survival rates can be you know, very different across different groups of our community. We know that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people are twice as likely to die of cancer, all cancers, compared to people who are not Indigenous. We know that culturally diverse people, people with disabilities and other priority populations are not doing as well. We have the best survival in the world. In most of our cancers, we do extremely well, but that isn't equitable for everybody, and equity is such an issue for us.
And in fact, for rare cancers, we've not seen the advances, the improvements in survival that have been seen
really?
For the common cancer types. And that's probably due to a whole lot of reasons, but not having enough
How
data.
How stark is the difference?
And not having access. Well, some of the others have really, you know, improved up towards 80% survival rates, and the rare cancers are often sitting down around, you know, 30 to 50%. So it is understandable when we're saying we don't know as much about them and we don't have as good access to drugs. But that's why we have quite a few of us in Australia trying to make a difference and bring together nationally focused platforms to improve many of the things we've discussed today.
Do you feel like you're cutting through?
I do think people are aware now, and Rare Cancers Australia is a huge part of that because they've spent so much time lobbying government, and I think the pharma companies as well. But at the end of the day, you know, drug access does come down to business a lot of the time. And also getting grants to run these trials is extremely tough. So if we have success rates of around 10% for grant application calls, you can see why for a rare cancer that doesn't have the background in research, you might not be as likely to get up as a cancer type that's more common where there's more knowledge.
Chris has called from Caulfield. Chris, you've been listening to a lot of this. What's prompted you to call in?
Oh, nice to talk to you, Rochelle. Yeah, just for disclosure, Claire Scott and I used to be colleagues, so I just wanted to acknowledge that at WEHI. I'm CEO of an Australian company developing a drug for pancreatic cancer, which falls into broadly the rare cancer space. And I just wanted to acknowledge, you know, the challenge of doing clinical trials and recruiting patients for a trial, and in particular for patients who have rare cancers who might be interested in being part of a clinical trial. There is the Australian New Zealand Clinical Trial Registry, which is an online database that you can search to see if there are clinical trials in your particular cancer, and if so, where they are. And the other thing I wanted to mention too, particularly to people in regional areas, that there generally is support for patients to you know, to travel or to stay in a city or an area where they're running the clinical trial itself. So patients shouldn't feel, you know, totally isolated, that there is opportunity for them to take part in clinical trials, even if they are in the city.
You mentioned barriers, Chris, to be able to get people onto clinical trials. What sort of barriers are you talking about?
Oh, I think, you know, getting the message to patients and to community oncologists that clinical trials are running in this particular disease area can be quite difficult. We spend a lot of time and effort talking about our clinical trial. But, you know, as was noted by Claire and Danielle, clinical trials take a long time, and some of that is because it's difficult to recruit patients onto your trial.
And we hear that, and we often hear patients saying, I asked about a trial and my oncologist said there wasn't anything for me, and that's where the conversation ends. And it is about that empowerment. How do you go beyond that? What's the next sentence that a person can have? And that might be, well, can you refer me to someone who I might be able to talk to? And everybody has the right to have that conversation. And the other area that people can search for a trial is on Cancer Council's website, trial.org.au. It's patient friendly. You can put in some key terms, and you can also call us on 13 11 20 and we can help you navigate through that website. So I think that's my key message. Even if the doctor that you're seeing or the treating team you're seeing say there's no trials that we can offer you, have that next conversation and ask, well, what else? Who else could I see?
And we are actually in the midst now of having the Victorian Rare Cancer Trials Alliance, which is bringing together a lot of different parties. And that is precisely to do what Danielle said, just to do it
this
better.
Is kind of the
streamline.
Power that you need. And yeah. I say that in a good way. Like
and streamline knowledge so that then we would be able to afford to have fellows, for example, medical oncology fellows, who would take on a case and know exactly where in Victoria to direct that person.
Chris, thanks for your call. Claire, one thing we haven't touched on is the incredible work and research that you do into ovarian cancer. And if we want to take some good out of this, right, is to look at some of the changes in research and information, some of the treatment that's gone into ovarian cancer. In your lifetime and within your working lifetime, what kind of advances have you seen in something like ovarian cancer?
Well, if we look back nearly 20 years to 10 years to 2006, we had our first trial of a PARP inhibitor drug in Australia, and that type of drug, the PARP inhibitor, has transformed the future for many women with ovarian cancer. So one of the most severe forms of ovarian cancer is called high-grade serous ovarian cancer, and half of those women, the cancer would be susceptible to a PARP inhibitor. So we've had approvals from the government. We had a big approval last year, so really that half of those women, which is an extraordinary number, now have access to appropriate molecular testing at diagnosis, and then they can get access to that drug. And that really has meant that many more women will be cured of ovarian cancer, we hope, from that first-line treatment. It'll take another sort of 5 years or so before we really are certain of that, but the trials that we've held have been incredibly encouraging. So our lab has been working on PARP inhibitor resistance for the last sort of 10 years, and we discover different mechanisms for why the PARP inhibitor stops working, and then design approaches to ensure that in the future for other women, they'll be able to be given, for example, additional drugs in addition to the PARP inhibitor, so that the PARP inhibitor will work better for longer.
Thank goodness we have people like you out there, you know, and doing and dedicating your life and your research and your work to this, because it changes lives. And every little bit of research, every little discovery, every clinical trial leads to the next step and to the next step. And baby steps, small steps are just as important, I could imagine.
That's exactly right. And I've definitely seen, you know, research and clinical trial data change people's lives in the last, you know, 5 to 10 years especially. And that happens because of research. We need to increase our research budgets at every level from every source, you know, that's government, philanthropy, corporate, whatever. And, you know, I think that the concept, I mean, patients walking down the street, they want to take part in research. They don't want the ethical and governance delays that we have. of course they're important, and I'm because we need to make sure that we're doing the right ethical things. But sometimes there are delays that just don't really make sense, and people don't usually want that.
There's plenty of information out there. The Cancer Council's website is incredible. It's very easy to use, and it is so thorough. You can also call the Cancer Council 13 11 20. You've mentioned Rare Cancer Australia. I had a great look through their website, and that is amazing as well. I think if today's program, you know, if you've only listened to a little bit of it, maybe there's someone in your life you want to share it with. Don't forget the Conversation Hour is also a podcast. As I mentioned earlier, we've done an entire program on clinical trials, Danielle, of which you are one of. So if today's program was of interest to you, then we have others on this. Go to the ABC Listen app or throw Conversation Hour podcast into your search engine. Danielle Spence, Head of Strategy, Support Division of the Cancer Council Victoria, thank you so much again for your time and to your entire team for the work that you do. And Professor Claire Scott, who's the Joint Division Head of Clinical Discovery Translation, the Head of Ovarian and Rare Cancers Laboratory at the Walter and Eliza Hall Institute of Medical Research. Thank you for all of your work and for your time today. And a huge thank you to Neil, who rang in. And Neil, we wish you all the best and your hike as well, because there are lots of people thinking about you. The Cancer Council's phone number again is 13 11 20. You can call them. There is always someone there for you to speak to. And if you want more information on clinical trials, go to the Cancer Council's website. Don't forget, you can listen back or pass on today's program. The Conversation Hour is also a podcast. I'll speak with you tomorrow. Until then, take care.